You are listening to Fair Enough by Art Cologne and Texte zur Kunst. Your deep dive into the global art world. Thoughtful, intentional, and always ready to play.
Hello and welcome to Fair Enough, a podcast series by Art Cologne in collaboration with Texte zur Kunst. Fair Enough brings together artists, curators, writers, and thinkers to reflect on how art and its institutions are responding to the urgencies of our present moment. This season, marking the 35th anniversary of Texte zur Kunst, we're taking up the journal's motto for the year, "There is no art without criticism." Each episode returns to a past issue of the journal to revisit the debates it sparked and to consider how those questions continue to shape the cultural and political landscape today. Today's conversation reflects back on Texte zur Kunst's issue on exhibition politics, which was just recently released this past summer in June 2025. My name is Michaela Dixon, and I'm your host. And today we are joined by Manuel Borja Villel. Manuel is an art historian and curator. He has been the director at the Museo Reina Sofia in Madrid from 2008 to 2023. During his tenure, he carried out a radical remodeling of the collection and created the Museo en Red, a network of organizations, collectives, and institutions that question the museum and expand its boundaries from beyond. Prior to this, Borja Villel was director at the MACBA in Barcelona and at the Fundació Antoni Tàpies. As director of these institutions, he developed an extensive body of work that has entailed a turning point in contemporary curatorial practice, resignifying narratives and exhibition devices, and their role in the governance of the institution. Most recently, he has been one of the curators of the 35th Sao Paulo Biennial, and in 2023, he received the Bard College Audrey Irmas Award for Curatorial Excellence. He is also a foreign fellow of the Academy of Arts and Letters. Thank you so much for joining us today, Manuel. I recently read your email exchange with Marcelo Resende under the title "To Leave the Institution" in the recent issue of Texte zur Kunst on exhibition politics. I wanted to propose that we use this as a starting off point for the conversation and ask you about the circumstances that led to your being, as you say, driven out of your position as director of the Museo Reina Sofia in 2023.
Okay, first, I would like to make clear what it happened, not for biographical reasons, but because it's pertinent, let's say, to a possible discussion about institutions, censorship, cultural wars, etc. So being specific, I was for 15 years in Reina Sofia. That was the maximum that you could be there under one contract, because, you know, the contract is 5 years and it could be renewed 2 times, so 15 it was maximum. And then you could continue, but to continue, you could you had to present yourself to, again, a public competition. So that's very, very clear. And so that was not the problem. The problem was I was doubting myself in the sense that I was already between Reina Sofia, MACBA, Museum Contemporary in Barcelona, Museo Tàpies. I have been 35 years in public institutions, Western European institutions, and I was already, and now, for example, I'm developing other things, and people complain, especially in Spain, how come after being 35 years in museums, he now claims that we have to leave the museums? So actually, I've been trying to do that right since the beginning, from the Tàpies Museum, because it was a monographic museum, and it was, you know, it was clear, and actually, from the start, me and my team, we wanted to do something else out of this place, and of course in Reina Sofia. And there we created a set of structures that we call Museo en Red, and the structures, they were organisms, entities that they were autonomous. We can talk about that later. And so that was already an exit. But still, all the structures were very much, let's say, I'm not so sure if to say European center, but certainly they were very European. And even if they were leftist, whatever, and I thought that the museum can only, or whatever we want to call it, the non-museum, this other form of institution, can only happen when there is a strong interpellation from outside. And we can talk, also what I mean from outside. And so I was doubting if to stay or the need about leaving and doing something else. So in that process, where actually I already committed myself in Brazil and committed myself to work horizontally with a group of colleagues, friends, which they are Afro-descendants, to work from a different place. So I already, in a way, I had already left like 6 months before my departure, because actually the two jobs are incompatible according to the Spanish law. You cannot be director of museum and director. So, but before even I was able to think what to do, and while I was discussing with my team if continue or not, there was a strong attack. I mean, really, really, also plan the right and ultra right. And now, as you know, everywhere the difference between right and ultra right is disappearing. They started attacking myself personally and Reina Sofía. And the idea is, the reason is because Reina Sofía, the structure, the team had, according to them, too much power. It was too independent. We have created, it was extremely autonomous, cannot be touched politically. So that was, let's say, a tower to destroy. And that to me, and it was vicious, it was really very strong. It was even, they mentioned where I live to maybe think to see if somebody had nasty ideas. So it was really vicious. And but to me, that was a symptom of something that it was already happening, which is cultural wars, and how the institutions were beginning to be attacked by the right. And there was, if during periods in the 90s, when I was working in Magba or in Tapies, I was working with collectives, that they were very suspicious of institutions. And at one moment we thought, okay, we have to take the institutions and democratize the institutions. That the ultra-right, who seems to have read Gramsci a lot, is something they have assumed. They have to take the institutions. And actually, after I left, next thing, IBAM in Valencia. It was something that they, and that's been going on in different places. And now in America with Trump, is like a grotesque example of all of that.
Yeah, especially when you see, I guess, the recent phenomenons, or maybe not so recent now, with the Smithsonian in particular. So this idea, yeah, that, you know, governments have to have a kind of control in, or an agenda, let's say, in exhibition making and art context, when they feel that the revolutionary capacities maybe are quite enormous or beyond what they can imagine, let's say, in the in public consciousness. What do you think, I guess the flip question is, what do you think is at stake when governments have this control, or when they assert this control at the level of exhibition making?
Yeah, there are different things there. First, on the one hand, why we have to think why the ultra-right is so obsessed with culture? Because, you know, normally our experience in past decades is that we used to complain that governments, especially in Europe, they don't care about culture. So we want them to get involved, to give us more money. That was our fight for decades, besides the fact that we need autonomy and all those things. So why the ultra right? You know, for example, in my 15 years in Reina Sofía and before, to have a review from one of those ultra right magazines and newspapers that attacked me, it was like, you have to fight to get them review an exhibition, to do an interview and to an artist. So they didn't care at all about that. But then suddenly, they were obsessed with institution and started writing pages and pages. Why is that happening? I think it's happening because there is a fight, a cultural war, a fight for the story. You know, whoever gets the narrative controls the thing. And actually, this is happening. I mean, we know we live in a system which is a system based in violence since 16th century. We know we live in a system that is collapsing. That doesn't work. I mean, probably we're already witnessing a kind of third world war in different type of intensity, a kind of hybrid new type of. And clearly, the institutions, especially Europe, do not seem to be able to confront all these crises. Look, the immigration crisis a few years ago. Look, Palestine. Look, look. The relation, the economical, the taxes with the states. So in that context, the ultra right. So in that context, I think culture, museums, art is very important because we deal with affection, we deal with existential territories, we deal with something that they manage. Very clear. I will give you an example which is very precise. In the case of Spain, the economy now is going very well, and according to the Central Bank of Spain, which I mean is not suspicious at all, of being leftist, it's a bank, it's the National Bank. They mentioned already that one of the reasons, one of the main reasons that the economy in Spain is going very strong is because of the immigrants. Because there are many immigrants, they are doing jobs that the Spaniards do not want to do, or they are all too old to do. They are normally young, so they contribute, they work. Normally, they don't get sick and they don't get pension because they are young. So actually, in that context, the ultra right is saying that the system is going very bad, everything is very bad because of the foreigners. All that has to do with storytelling, all that has to do with existential territories, and that is being controlled. Or another example, there is a big fight now in Europe and in Spain, and I guess it's in Europe in general, is that Europe is getting older, so we need more money for retirement. So that money comes from public services, and those public services, they are being paid by taxes. You have, on the other hand, younger people that they don't have housing, they don't have permanent jobs. That means the system is fucked up. That means something is going wrong. So it means that maybe wealthier people should pay more taxes, whatever. However, the same thing happens as with immigrants. They change, the ultra right change the story, and what it happens, they created a fight between generations. The fault is of the boomers because they spend too much money. Well, the boomers, actually, we pay our taxes before, so we earn our retirement. So in that context, storytelling culture really has a centrality. What happened? So the problem actually is not only that is public govern, public is the public institutions or public or the governments, they interfere in the museums. That of course is happening in the States, is happening in places. But the problem is when the frame that is created that looks natural somehow conditions the way we deal of the way the way we discuss. And I think this is very important. And I think that's what actually is at stake, is how to discuss not only the contents, not only, let's say, an exhibition, but the way an exhibition is made. Not only the collection, but if we need collections based on property. So that to me is the big issue.
One of the things that kind of makes me think about is you mentioned before this question of like autonomous structures, this question of like how you direct a museum in this day and age amidst this po these political crises, but also climate crisis, etc. On the it seems almost it's an interesting way to frame it, but to me on some level it seems like on the right you have this way of kind of taking over the institution, maybe politically of course, but also to get a very clear kind of message across. Then let's say on the left, let's say we make it just like this for simplicity too. Then on the left too, there's a question of also how to rethink, restructure the institution to continue it on some level, to continue or to try to find a way forward, which is clearly also in a kind of crisis or in a kind of proposes, I would almost call it like a large, a question mark. You write in the recent issue of Texas Kunst on exhibition politics, specifically that there's no resistance or revolution without what you call an instituting process. And that, let's say, progressive gestures, so things that I would call or I would see as ways that we can, revolutionize the institution, just become that, mere gestures. How do you see the way forward, or how do you see this continuing to play out today in museums?
Okay, thank you for the question because that allows me. I stopped my former qu the question before because otherwise it becomes not ending, but allows me to link both things in the sense that I will pick up in the other qu in the form in the other question in the sense that which type of, let's say, censorship we have today. I mean, one again is the brutal one, and that's very easy. I mean, it's not that it's easy to solve, but you know, like it's happening in the States or it's happening in other cases when there are issues that you are not allowed to touch, like genocide, like Palestine. So that's there, but there are more. Another kind of let's say a structure that creates a space which is not free is an administrative structure that conditions what you have do you what you can do. Administrative structures today, they're basically the objective is to produce events, to produce a spectacle. So it's very difficult, not to say impossible, according to European law, to support research. You know, research is long time process. Basically, you cannot pay. I mean, you can pay a misery, but nobody can live with the amount of money a museum would be able to pay for research, because maximum you can pay 15,000 euros, and you know, and research is supposed to take longer. So that's one. Second, normally all these laws, all these public biddings are done for co big companies that can do these things. Smaller groups, smaller collectives, it's almost impossible for them. So there you have something that already conditions a lot and it looks neutral. So that's something. So more in those terms of those laws, and that I've been confronted in my own practice. When I was in Barcelona, we were working, that was at the time of the anti-globalization movements, and we were working in the museum with them, part of public programs. I mean, something that today is totally natural. At the time, it was not so much. And actually, it was called by the police. And the reason is that you know, if you go to the mission and vision of the museum, it says that the museum is supposed to deal with art, with education, blah, 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 blah. And of course, going into the streets, for them, it was not art. But the problem is, everything is art. If you deal with Maya communities, you know, in Guatemala, now you have extraordinary artists. The Antonio Pichilla, Benvenuto Chabahai, Manuel Chabahai, Benlim Boroboro. I can continue. It's really extraordinary. However, in their languages, in Maya languages, the word art does not exist. That's quite interesting because let's say they have a museum. In their mission, it will be whatever they have several terms to deal with what we call art. In those terms, the difference between, let's say, craft, the ecology, spirituality, do not exist. So that means that when we talk about art museums, we already are putting a frame, and a frame that is artificial, because you know, often they complain, why you do political art? And you know, is political to charge a ticket? I mean, certainly that's not artistic, so whatever it is. So I think it's important. That's something that we have to consider when we do. Then there is another level that also, in terms of frame of terms of, let's say, lack of freedom, is when what we discuss, and I say, I've been doing, I'm been working with the relationship between arts and politics for a long time, but I really dislike political art, which is literal, which is very bad art, which is non-interesting, because there is one moment when the political or anything, the colonial, becomes a rhetorical figure, becomes just a commodity, becomes something that you exchange. That's really not interesting, because what is interesting, and that goes to your question now, what is interesting is what Fanon and now Françoise Berger in her last book call total disorder. And we should be not afraid, especially in museums, of total disorders, in the sense that the only way we can create an alternative, the only way I think art, poetics could have a function is to question all the time the institutions. The institutions, especially museums since the 18th century, they are specialists in taking things out of life. I mean, what a museum does, you get a car, you put it in a museum, it's designed. You are not, you get a cross and you put it in a museum, it's not anymore a religious object. And that you could go on and on, a butterfly. So the challenge is to put the museum, the art back to life. And the only possibility is in the sense that Fanon used the word, this element of total disorder, this element of questioning the institution all the time. Of course, that's much more complex for administration, for those public buildings, for those. But that challenge is actually the difference between a society which is collapsing, a society which is not able to confront their challenges, and something that we would hope it should be a different type of future.
Yeah, it reminds me a lot of like this question of like dissidents as being this like healthy force within organizations as ways to rethink, as ways to, yeah, bring to the fore certain realities. It also reminds me of, I don't wish to make this too discursive, but this text of Derrida from some time ago called The University Without Condition. It's the same kind of, it's this question of like, it's not so much to do with, I mean, maybe it is actually to do with this kind of this question in a way of censorship, and that like, if you can bring everything, if you can really bring everything into an arena to, and you can have a process by which you decide almost as like a, as an institution, what can hold and what doesn't hold. And that there's, but I think those are interesting kind of frameworks to think in institutions now, where you have kind of an idea of market value as well, where you have an idea that certain things that are shown become, let's say, not just darlings in the art market, but can do, and that these decisions also are have humongous consequences or humongous benefits to people who benefit from them the most. It leads me in a bit of a roundabout way to this question about a revolution has having to come from outside. I wonder, to you, who constitutes the outside? Does it have to be like a general public? Does it have to be like activists? Does it have to be insiders who are, let's call them dissidents, or insiders who've become less, who are less, let's say, in love with the status quo or something like this?
First, I agree totally with what you say before, and you know this, and also I think that institutions or museums or culture or the art system, it should be the non-art system. It should be a place where of absolute disorder, but also means absolute freedom, where everything, where the society should be able to negotiate all the terrors, all the things that are not able to negotiate otherwise. And so therefore, to me, it should be no limits to freedom in a museum, no limits whatsoever. And that's why the questioning this absolute disorder can only happen from outside. Of course, the outside, we cannot, it would be a kind of ethnographic and very European to think that the outside is, you know, somebody that is really, I don't know, somebody other, because there are many outsides. So, of course, you have outsides in Europe, you have outsides everywhere, in the sense that an outsider is the one that doesn't fit, is the one that you are outside in terms of class, in terms of gender, in terms of race, in terms of, so there are many from many areas where this interpolation should happen, and this interpolation should happen in terms of language, as I said before. In many languages, there are no word for art. In terms of dispositives, there are many cultures which are, for example, in museums, we are very much object or document based. But there are many cultures where the document of the object is just instrumental to do something else. For example, the Amazigh, where or the cultures that are oral. To be an oral culture, it means that you could have an object, but unless you have this orality, the object is like having a piano without nobody touching it. It's just a dead object. But to have the orality, it doesn't mean that you record. And again, you monumentalize, and after all, there is a very strong link between document and monument, and you put it in an archive. To be oral, it means that the history, oral communities are communities that their history has to be told, tell and retold and retold all the time. Because when you stop, if you stop, the story dies. I mean, there is no. And to do that, it means changes of governance. Because you are not just a witness. It's not that the museum goes to a community, which they do that very often, and then you get the testimony, and then you keep the testimony, and you forget to the community, and that happens, as we know, very often, and is full of contradictions, especially in Europe, where you have museums doing exhibitions, let's say, about Ghana, Senegal, whatever, all the time. But then, and they are public institutions. Then the same government that pays for these exhibitions deny the visas to other country, is what Ariel Azoulay was saying in her first film about unlearning imperialism. It's like we want the objects, which are beautiful, but we don't want the people that made the objects. So all those, all these questionings imply really transformations in terms of governance, in terms of concepts, in terms of, to whom belong, talking about restitution. We deal with the idea of restitution because we deal with the idea of property. If we question the idea of property, then the restitution, it becomes not an issue because it's not even yours. So it's not even yours to restitute. It belongs to everybody. So this kind of interpolation, to me, is absolutely necessary. This is something that actually is happening, in the sense that the force, the strength of Afro descendants communities, indigenous communities, feminisms, etc., are so strong that those things are happening. That's also why I think the ultra-right became so obsessed with cultures, in a way similar to what happened in the 20s and the 30s, when the Popular Front became so strong, immediately you had the reaction. And I just think that institutions, we should think about that, in the sense that if we only think in terms of exhibitions without thinking the frame in which the exhibitions are based, then we are just accomplices. We are just keep on doing the same thing that we criticize.
Yeah, it's an interesting point. I mean, even thinking about property ownership, it also leads me to wonder whether on some level this crisis, let's call it like a crisis of the museum, a crisis of museology or something like this, whether it was always inevitable, whether it was always somehow, let's say the museums, it leads me to a question I want to come back to later about really museums being kind of like an 18th century project, let's say, but whether this was always inevitably going to crash. We didn't know when, but now we see like the seeds kind of really blossom now into the failures, but it feels like this real crisis where we ask ourselves, okay, do you abandon the project of museums? Do you seek alternatives instead? What would those alternatives look like? Or do we stay out within this structure and try to rethink decolonization until we think we find a good answer?
Yeah, I am actually. Thank you. The thing is, museums are incredible, refined, strong institutions created in the 18th, in the 18th century. I mean, really, I don't know who invented them, but they're. I mean, the society, the bourgeoisie that invented created the museums in the 18th, 19th century created a strong, very refined machinery. That machinery, it was based on, how you say in English, Luther, in taking things,
Lutheran. Yeah.
in taking things from,
Looting. Yes, yes,
yeah,
yes. Yeah,
exactly.
stealing. Yeah.
Stealing, yeah. Clearly, it was based in showing one history, history of progress, white history, where the colonies, they were just instrumental. And I mean, it's very significant that you have 18th, 19th century, the encyclopedic museums. It was also about creating discipline, control, all those things that we know. But that goes parallel to the international fairs, since the one in London in 1851, one after, and you know, they're about light, progress, technique, and also about is the period of human zoos, is the period. So everything goes hand by hand. So clearly, this type of institution, when the system, the imperial system, was collapsing, it was supposed to, I mean, it's supposed to collapse. But of course, the system is extremely refined and as strong as the empires, the colonial system in which we live is and keeps mutating. What is the difference between 18th, 19th century and today is that things got confronted. I mean, in a way, I don't think there is a, it's very difficult to do a kind of middle point. It's different, it's difficult to arrive to a consensus and to have something that will make everything everybody happy, because it's actually impossible. On the one hand, the history, the many genocides of history that we've been used to see in museums, now we see them alive. So that's something that it's impossible to avoid. I mean, it's in the streets, that's clear. On the other hand, the fight of the ultra-right to take the museums, look again, Smithsonian, to keep histories hidden, things that a few years ago looked impossible, now they are happening. So that means that things are extremely polarized. In that situation, to me, the only possible thing is the exodus, is to leave the museums. But that, again, we have to be very careful. Things, they are not so easy, because then, you know, we will be already in paradise if we were so easy. And so I would not, as you know, there are many people today claiming for abandoning everything, from leaving. And to abandon, I think it's too easy. It's too romantic in the bad sense of the word. I mean, it's like, I mean, you abandon, I mean, why only Europeans, white Europeans seem to want to be wanted to abandon things? I mean, because they can, maybe they can leave. To black women in certain, I don't know, in Africa or in Caribe, they could abandon. Could the people from Haiti abandon Haiti? I mean, in any case, if they leave, is they leave as immigrants? Is not. So I think we have to do to propose an exodus, but an exodus doesn't mean to abandon. It means to work in the ruins of this institution. That means to find alternatives. That means to create a structure with things that already happen. And we have examples in history. I mean, these other alternative forms of organization, this network, it exists, networks of poetics, politics, solidarity. They existed, of spirituality. They existed in Afro descendants, Afro-American communities all the you know all the way since 17th century. They existed, for example, and I mentioned Latin America because it's an area I know a little bit better. And they existed during the dictatorships. That you know they were very tough since 1964 until the 90s. During those dictatorships, many political groups or artists they had to do a dialectics, a dialogue between remembering, between keeping a memory, but also forgetting. Because you know, they had very often they have to throw away archives because if they found them with the archives, they were condemned to prison or death. But on the other hand, they had to remember what it was happening. And you know, there is something very emotive. It's like you know, very often in Argentina, for example, when the military got somebody in the street, one of the first things they did is to cry aloud their name. So people would know he's been taken, because otherwise you disappear. And to disappear is to be erased from history, memory. So there is an element of forgetting memory, and that created different type of structures, which are about history, about poetics when they were artistic, about solidarity, about agency. So there are examples. So the idea is to abandon this 18th century model and to rebuild out of the ruins something else.
When you began your tenure at the Reina Sofía, which is largely a 20th century museum collection, there was a radical reinstallation of the collection. Would you speak to your approach to the early days, or how you envisioned starting that time, I guess, with reference to the history of museology starting in the 18th century?
Yeah, in the case of actually this, I've been working. I'm working on that. I'm doing that actually here in Barcelona, dealing with the 18th century. But in Madrid, and when I was in Madrid, the thing is, the two bigger institutions there, Prado and Reina Sofía, they are not encyclopedic at all, in the sense. And actually, there is a mistake when some of the directors of Prado, they want to turn Prado into metropolitan. It's a mistake. Because Prado, it was a royal collection, and a royal collection that was at war with almost everybody in the world. So of course they had Velázquez. And Velázquez was one of the, let's say, curators of the royal family. I mean, to have Velázquez as a curator, that's really quite something. So, so they have, you know, it's the best pinacotheque in the world with, you know, the Goyas, Velázquez, Zurbarán, Greco, Murillo, you name it. But however, and not one, like hundreds of, and however, they don't have any Rembrandt. Why not? Because they were at war with Rembrandt. They don't have any pre-Columbian art. Not even colonial art, because they didn't care. They, you know, the colonial pre-Columbian material for them, it was just gold to be melted and to be used for continue the war. So there is very little to restitute in the sense, because they melt all the. So that means it's not encyclopedic at all. It's so it's something. And the Reina Sofía is the same. It's a museum that was literally done to host Guernica. And Guernica is the big, and that's how we thought about the collection. Guernica is the big icon of the Spanish Republic. The Spanish Republic, by the way, which is, you know, the Spanish Republic was abandoned by Europe when the fascist Italians and Germans, they attack Spain. Europe decided to be neutral. Somehow reminds you of what is happening today. And so that means that Guernica was the icon of the exile. Guernica, it was the icon of the transition. It was the icon of all those people that fought against the Vietnam War. So we built the collection with that. We started building the collection dealing with this type of work in the 30s, what it means to be an artist in the 30s, what to be meant to be an artist in the exile. So the idea of diasporic language, the idea, it became very strong in the museum. So in that sense, it's not encyclopedic, it's a museum that is situated in a context, a specific context.
It reminds me of a quote. I don't know where I read it. Must have been like a few months ago, about when Guernica was on View, and or maybe I don't know if it was on View or whether these German soldiers had come into the studio of Picasso or was on View.
Ah, yeah.
It's you know this quote. It's like this interaction between a German soldier and Picasso about Guernica, and they say like, "How could you do this?" And he looks at them. He says, "How could you do this?"
Yeah,
It's
yeah.
quite like an amazing kind of synthesis of this moment in time of, yeah, I mean, thinking about like presence, absence, as you mentioned, but also this kind of like this question of like who authors the future, who responds to it, who kind of like makes, who
Yeah,
reflects the future.
and that deals with authorship, who's responsible, and in that case is one element of fight, but you could have it differently. For example, in this idea of the diaspora, very often diasporic language, the way it happens is that the colonizer or the immigrant uses the language of the other. The language of the colonizer. I mean, for example, in the medieval period in Spain, you have the figure of Saint Jack. Saint Jack, it was called Saint Jack, the one that kills Moors or the one that kills Jews. That after the when the Spaniards, the kingdoms of the Iberic Peninsula went to America, Saint Jack killing Moors became Saint Jack killing Indians or Saint Jack killing Black. But the th and that was like that. But the thing is, since they were forced to adopt the Spanish, the Catholic religion, Saint Jack killing Blacks became a Yoruba god. So they use differently. They use this element of oppression to create elements of resistance. So this, this idea of the diasporic, this idea of using language differently, that's something that to me was very important because also deals with ownership, that deals with authorship, to whom it belongs, to whom it belongs. Things that are communal, things that become to a community. That's, for example, with indigenous community, there is not element of individual authorship. And that really, is a total, again, is a total disorder in relation to how museums, collections are conceived.
So it also reminds me of this part of the Texer Kunst exchange where you mentioned Marcel Bruthaus, who's a quite an important Belgian artist. But this question of, I can't remember the quote perfectly in my mind, but it's something to do with how biennials exhibitions often take place. Do you call it on enemy territory or something like
Yeah.
this? And this question, which for me, when I read it, also raised some interesting questions about, yeah, I mean, let's say like forms of the Biennale as a form. Like if we move past exhibition making and we just even look at like biennials, which have different formats, that question, which sort of proposes, yeah, I mean, you know, to me, it made me ask, who is the enemy?
That's important in the sense, and the quote is by Brotars, and actually he was extremely conscious that he was quote quote always in enemy's territory because he was using a language that he was his own. He was, for example, in the art fair in Cologne, he did one of the itinerants of manifestations of the museum that he was called Museum of Modern Art, Department de Segle, and he was something like close for Fayit, for because so that was very interesting that he closed the museum in an art fair. So he was always and also, for example, he never did partitions, he never created new pedestals, new vitrines. He used whatever he had because he didn't want to add more objects or more things to a world that didn't need them. So he was very conscious, and that's quite important. Because talking about interpellation, questioning from outside, to deal that again, we are not, we keep talking about non-authorship or shared authorship, about the commons, about you know, we are totally in a different place, and you are in a fair, so we will be in a fair. We are so, but this reality of being in territory enemy and to be able to work from within, I think is quite important, and I think this is what Marcel Brotters did extraordinarily. He also was conscious, of course, of the limitations of being somewhere else. That's why also his work is always melancholic. There is melancholy is always there, and he knows that there is something else. So to me, this element of working in territory, enemies' territories, I think is quite important, and the diasporic language has to do with that.
The other part of the exchange that also really struck me was to do this question of when to know when it's better not to do an exhibition. So this kind of this machine of producing exhibitions and producing content and always having, yeah, a programmatic form. And then when an artist, in your case, it was between the museum and Michael Ascher decided not to do an exhibition, which is also quite a, it's a sort of a radical proposition when you've been in conversation also for several years, but it's interesting.
Yeah, that's actually quite difficult. And I had some of my colleagues, some friends, they are totally opposed to exhibitions or museums. I mean, totally. And actually, like exhibitions, in the sense that I think there is an element of performativity, there is an element of poetics, there is an element of, again, to use the word, total disorder. I mean, I just did an exhibition in Pompidou Metz called After the End. And I remember some of the discussions with the staff that they wanted to have like categories, like Caribbean, let's say, or popular or diaspora. And I didn't, because things are connected. And, you know, and that's something that in an exhibition you do, like, I think is one of the media where the dispositives where certain elements of the type that we are discussing there, you know, they suit the exhibition dispositive very much. As a matter of fact, some of the colonizer thinkers like Rolando Vázquez, he always contrapose the limitations that for him has the academy and the book format to the exhibition format. So to me, there is something important there. But of course, like again, we are using enemies' territory. I mean, we are talking about an imperial language, English. So, but maybe we can change it to Spanish, and still it would be an imperial language. So that's there you have it. I mean, there are concepts that they are in another languages that we cannot even think of. You know, it becomes impossible for us to think of. So, in that contradiction, of course, exhibitions, they are a lot also about spectacle, about production, about so when to stop. That's also a poetical and a strategical exhibition in the text, Zurkunst magazine. I think I mentioned that this project that I did, which that I didn't do actually with Michael Ascher, that it was an exhibition, and only I think we lasted 7 years. We were working on that. Only at the end, when he stopped, and actually he decided not to do the exhibition, and it was not a fight. That was. It's just after a while I realized that was the process. Not to do it, and of course, not to do it is not just sleeping. That is also.
Something.
Stalinowicz did a piece about that. But not to do it implies, you know, implies a reflection, implies an activity, implies an action. When to do it or when not to do it, that's, you know, it's not something that it cannot be a formula. It's something the same way that a work of art is not a formula, or an exhibition is not something that you do in a paper and then you apply. It's something is performative. So this is the difference.
Was there ever a result, or was there ever, apart from in this article where it was clear that there was something that could have been and then was not, was there ever a kind of, because what it just made me think of now is this was let's say in the past, yeah, let's say year, this sort of strategy that's been adopted by certain artists when to take themselves out of exhibitions, so to, let's say, make a statement or to have their name crossed out, but the name remains. And it's sort of been this interesting moment of thinking about how you give or you don't give, but that once again, this relationship between presence and absence is so close, is so tight that actually one, of course, does not exist without the other, but even in name, even in statement, even in blah, 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 these things are existing performatively in a way that is political, no doubt, but also in a way that continues the relevancy, the project, the practice of certain artists.
Yeah, again, that's very thin, and that's the difference between good art, so-so art, strongly political art, or when politics become rhetoric. I mean, after all, our discourse is in general the same way that in the 50s the discourse was about whatever informal, organic, whatever, or in the 40s. So today is about the colonization. That's the and in that context, that's our territory. In that context, you have people that could be cynical. And they cross their name, but the name becomes very visible. There are people that use the suffering of others to create their own work, which is also cynical. I really dislike that. But there are people that are really extremely refined. For example, one artist, in terms of erasure, in terms of not participating, not participating. One artist that to me was extraordinary was Stally Brown. He actually disappeared from everywhere, but his disappearing, it was never a commodity, never. So that's a really extraordinary way. Brotars, it was another case. Or another one in a different matter is the Vietnamese filmmaker and writer Trinh Minh Hà. She deals with the interval and with this element which is always in between. How to do that? That's actually, to me, that's one of the key issues. One of the key issues at the moment is not to be inside, because we don't want to be in a world that condemns people to death. We don't want to be in a world where everything becomes a commodity. Where something that makes me very upset is museums in this frame of mind that we are, all of them talk about solidarity, all of them talk about, but then their directors, their curators, they cannot be more competitive. So it's like, how you deal with both things. So the idea is in that well, of course, not to leave, not to abandon, I mean, to leave, but not abandoning, to work in the interval, in the way that, again, I think Minh Hà in this sense is extraordinary. To me, that's the issue today. And that is Minh Hà or Ariel Azoulay, are they artists? Are they researchers? Are they activists? So maybe they are everything and not at the same time. And that doesn't mean that they are not. I mean, Minh Hà has done one of the some of the best films in the in the late 20th century, early 20th century, 21st century.
I have two more questions. One is a bit about this notion that you've touched on a few times, which is called existential territory, which I've understood to be a notion of Félix Guattari, the quite famous post-structuralist. One of the things that attracted me so much to this notion or to this idea was when it was kind of spoken about, actually in this kind of well-known Eflux journal that was called "What's Love Got to Do with It?" That was published in 2013. There's a conversation at the end of The Reader, which is sort of about how we can, I think the article's called How We Start Living in Trees or How We Begin Living in Trees. So again, it's this question of rethinking the institution. The way that existential territory is used is kind of is talking about how an alternative would be a temporary coalition. So it's kind of a question of energy in particular. The duality seems to be that institutions, when they become institutions, so institutionalized, they tend to lose the energy that made them what they were in the first place. That certain kind of temporary coalitions, but not just certain kind of collectives, we would say nowadays, bring together something of the current moment, which is quite energetic. And when those things become like A good example would be like artist-run spaces when they've been around for X amount of time. Those do become institutions. They change ownership in several ways. Maybe the members change, but how do you maintain energy? How does a thing, whether it becomes an institution or not, maintain a kind of, energetic life force?
Yeah, that's like the interval. That's one of the key issues, because institutions, they have, especially because we have the tendency to think into private and public. But you know, at the end, nowadays, the public is like the public is being run like private. I mean, let's say for the good of everybody, it's supposed to be, but very often the administrative things. So that's one, because then step by step you start creating rules. As I said, very clear. We talk about affection. I mean, everybody's talking, and then there is nothing more competitive, more cruel, very often, than the art world. So there is there you have it. There is really a big problem. Or talk about these artists, curators, whatever, that let's say they work collectively, they work anonymously, they work with the communities, but then you know their name is really you know is you know, it's collective, but their name is really very, very present. So that's a problem. Second problem is that institutions, at the end, they create some kind of community, and they create a collective mentality. So you have very often, I mean, and I can say through experience, in the sense that suddenly somebody attacks the institution or criticizes the institution. The first reaction when you are, fortunately, there are other reactions, but the first reaction is like to defend. I mean, without maybe thinking, okay, maybe they're right. And it's, you know, it's not an attack to our work. It's an attack to the frame. I mean, that's the to the history we all carry. And but then and then there is something else, is that the system, as I said, is very refined. And one of the elements that we forgot to discuss before, in terms of censorship of frame, fixed frame of reference, is precarity. And what does precarity do is, after a while, resentment. I mean, I have many, many colleagues that work very tough in smaller institutions, dealing with immigration, dealing with doing incredible job. But then after a while, after decades of working there, of not having salaries, or having or bad salaries, or spending all the time with an incredible small budget, and at the end they get resentful. And what is the result? Resentment is kind of the seed for the ultra right, in the sense that their positions become extremely reactionary, extremely defending. So for that, the only solution is to think in this kind of existential territory, in this thing that is thought, rethought continually. What to me, but maybe of course there are others. One solution to me is not private, not public, but the commons. And why the commons is different? Because let's say is in the laws, in the private or the public. You know, private. Let's say you have a private museum, is your decision. I mean, you have to follow laws, in the sense that to fire somebody, to hire somebody, you have to follow some kind of laws. If you are in a public, you have to follow public laws, but it's there. I mean, if you are common, and let's say you create a community of curators, publics, whatever, you have to negotiate every time. Every time, let's say you create a structure of the commons where there is a constituency. You have to, I mean, that's tough, because that implies lock, is a different type of timing, different type of governance. So this continuous negotiation implies this continued rethinking, implies that an institution has to change continually. And that's important. I mean, for example, here in Barcelona, where I am, there is a museum about immigration that used to be an extraordinary museum in the 90s, very progressive, very, you know, with extraordinary museography. But the immigration in the 90s, it was normally immigration from south of Spain. It was immigration. The immigration now is from Africa, or is And for those immigrants, that museum is one of the more reactionary. I mean, they don't relate at all. And you know how the an institution that was extremely progressive at one moment becomes just the opposite. That's an example. And to me, that the only solution is these other forms of institutionality. The commons, it could be one, but of course there are other examples like in quilombos, in other types. But the commons for me would be an example of how that could be done differently. That of course is very tough because we all know that, you know, we do exhibitions and then we play between both systems. And you want to negotiate everything, but then you have a deadline. You have this, and the deadlines are impossible with the other thing. So it's, you know, if it was simple, probably we would not be talking about all this now.
No, probably not. It's a constant state of negotiation. My last question, which kind of connects to one of the themes that's been discussed in the podcast series so far, is it's kind of about the current moment and how you see it possibly periodized in the future. As you're also an art historian, I wanted to ask you how you think the current epoch will be periodized, especially when it comes to terms like we hear nowadays, quite a well-known term is immediacy. But I'm sort of thinking, and I've been thinking a lot about immediacy through the frame of in contemporary art, but it seems that there's never really time for the dust to settle. So we're constantly seeing new, and there's an influx of information all the time. I kind of wonder whether what your take on not just the idea of immediacy is, but on how you would see or how you would predict, yeah, this art historical moment to be periodized.
Okay, as an art historian, I have the tendency always to think in the long term. So what is happening today, actually, we could trace their many origins, of course. I mean, we could go back to 16th century, but, you know, this podcast doesn't, you know, it would take several podcasts to go back to 16th century. But one immediate, let's say, origin, it could be the 70s, you know, when neoliberalism, when the liberal model got into question with May 68, and then there is this reaction of neoliberalism that has to deal with the end of Eastern Europe, etc., etc. So in that element, so that's the frame where we are, that starts in the 70s, and there are fights with conceptual art, with different type of practices, with the Zapatistas in the 90s, both politics, organization, spirituality, Afrodescendant, etc., etc. That would take long. But to go into the immediacy, that's an issue. I think there is something I always, you know, I mentioned in some of my lectures, which always struck me, which is in 2006, when the Trump mob went into the Capitol, normally having dealt with Latin America coup d'etats, with the coup d'etat in Spain in the 30s, something that really became kind of strange is that when people went into the Capitol, once they were inside, they didn't know what to do.
Yeah.
They started taking selfies. It's like, so, and that looks idiotic, and, you know, it's like, why they do all these things to put just their feet on the on top of the table of Nancy. Yeah, it's like, why? And I think that makes sense because the difference between the dictators in the 30s and the dictators now, the dictator now is like the spokesman of, you know, in a commercial, in a mall that just says sales in the third floor, or, you know, it's like talks. But, you know, the movement exists besides the grotesque figure of the spokesman. And where is the movement? The movement is in the public, in the let's say, in the leftist thinking multitude, in the neoliberal thinker, the consumer, the audiences, the likes, that's the change. A change where historically, since the avant-garde, since the romantic, since the 19th century, the artist was at the center, and now I think at the center is the multitude. being a leftist multitude or a progressive multitude. And that's something that the ultra right has really understood perfectly. The left has theorized. I mean, you have Negri, Michael Hart. I mean, there are many theories, but I don't think has been able to do it in terms of politics, forms of organization, or let's say in our own terms, in something that really puts upside down their system. So this is, to me, we are in the crossroad of that. But again, the shift is from the romantic artist, from the dictator to the mall, to the consumer or to the multitude.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I agree with you.
Thank you for listening to Fair Enough by Art Cologne and Texte zur Kunst, where ideas travel and perspectives expand. From the world's first art fair to today's conversations on modern and contemporary art. The dialogue continues every fall live in Cologne. For more information, visit artcologne.com.